Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browning and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam. Whenever he's on, like this morning, Marjorie, do you remember you and I were marveling at how fitting his name is? Do you remember that conversation we had?
No, I don't.
We did this morning, because even if his last name, I think it was Marjorie who said this, weren't Beam, we'd still call him Beam, because remember you said this? Like a moonbeam, when things seem as dark as pitch, Alex's words pierce the bottomless black and light up the world.
Yes.
We live in. That's what you
said,
Alex Beam.
Bad metaphors. No one here writes for a living. That's
Alex
for sure.
Beam, it's very good to see you again. How are
hey,
you?
Hey, nice to see both of you.
Well, he
I'm
is
great.
Here.
Sun's shining. It's all right.
He is here to bring a little sunshine. It has been a little downer. Our conversation
important topics.
Bleak.
Casinos
there are important
and guns.
Topics, but they're
exactly.
not fun. Let's put it this way.
Right.
So I want to start here, Alex Beam, with something that is just crazy. The Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Robots. You wrote about it about a week or so ago. Please fill in.
Yeah. They don't get enough attention.
Yeah. I mean, this actually exists. It's not a joke.
Yeah, no, it does actually exist. And I had to phone this guy to find out. This is one of these columns that actually is a funnier idea to talk about the column than to actually have to write it and read it in a way. But I was reading some really serious blog and a very serious writer named Tom Ricks actually mentioned something called, he said, so the Robot Rights Coalition. And I phoned him. It turned out he was joking. But the link to Robot Rights Coalition took you to this bizarre academic paper by the lady, Ms. Darling, whom
yes.
I quote at some length. And then that eventually, once I discovered there was a Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Robots, I mean, what are you going to do, right?
Well, I guess what I'm not clear about, I mean, you did tell this incredible story about the people that were given this experiment. They were given these cute little robot dinosaurs. And this involved Ms. Darling that you just mentioned. So please tell us about Ms. Darling and the cute robot dinosaurs.
I'm surprised by your reaction, Jim. But I will briefly tell, because I got a lot of feedback on this one point in the column, which was sort of interesting. And it was something that she was able to back up. I asked her, she claimed that she does experiments, because she's a researcher, blah, blah, blah. I said, yeah, well, okay, like what? And she in a controlled environment, she puts people in a room and it gives them something called Pleo, capital Pleo, which is probably made in Japan. It costs about $150. You can get it on Amazon. It's a furry toy robot dinosaur. And then these are adults, basically, and she encourages the adults to interact with the furry robot toy dinosaur, give it a name, maybe have little games with it. And then after about 90 minutes, she gives him a hammer and says, now you must destroy this robot. And she's a social scientist in a sense, not a hard scientist. And to a person, people cringe, people decline, people don't want to destroy the robot.
Because
they bonded with the robot. And there's another example in that column, actually, that keeps coming up out of the Washington Post. Is how, and we all probably saw this movie Hurt Locker at one time
yes,
or another.
Yes.
We were the forced to or whatever. But
about the guy that was that took apart the bombs in Iraq.
Right. The director was the first woman to ever win Best Director Academy Award. Was she not?
In fact, well,
yes, she was.
She got the Academy Award for
Best Director.
And she did Zero Dark 30 too. Yeah, Catherine. She,
exactly.
Bigelow. Thank you.
Thank
married
you, John
to
Parker.
The guy
I feel like I had my
formerly
finger
married
formerly
to Mr.
Married
Titanic.
To Mr. Titanic. That's
is
correct.
That married? Really? We should go off on a tangent there.
But go ahead. Okay. What's your point?
Well, no, yeah, exactly. no, because you got to know that bizarre world of they actually stopped using people to
diffuse and dissemble
so-called improvised explosive devices, and they used these extremely complicated nine-legged robots. And a Washington Post reporter witnessed, both in the field and in training, the reason they had nine legs was because they could continue to function when a leg blew off. I mean, unlike a human.
Oh, God.
And, they're designed to within an inch of their life. And so what would happen is that the people managing the robots and even soldiers in the field would say, they'd see that the robot had lost four or five legs and say, bring the robot back. Because they felt the robot was hurting, and if it loses another leg, it'll die. And then there's another, and the soldiers often named the robots, and there's another example in the same Washington Post story of a guy, to be fair, he's a better writer than I am, and so he describes, what he's really describing is a guy carrying a heap of junk in his arms, and he's bringing this heap of junk back to a technical Army service depot, and he says, this is Scooby-Doo. Can you bring him back to That's life? Amazing. And, you know, because he perceives that this robot probably saved many lives.
Yeah, but maybe she should have read the Washington Post story, actually.
But hold on. I mean, on one hand, it does seem crazy. On the other hand, you know, we all saw R2-D2 in Star Wars, get very attached to him, the robot in Star Wars. And we all saw, a lot of us saw the movie Her, where the guy basically is having this mad, passionate love affair with his operating system on his computer. And you can see how it happens when they're sophisticated and they're engaging you in conversation. So is on the one hand, they don't have any feelings, unlike animals, but you can see where people get... Could you smash your little dinosaur robot?
Singularity. I read that in your column. That's what it is, right? The union of what is it again?
Well, it's a man and machine. That's my Newton neighbor, Ray Kurzweil, who I've like unceasingly mocked over the years, but has postulated that machine intelligence and human intelligence will be as one very soon. So you know, it's curious. I mean, so although Darling, the researcher, thinks he's full of beans and he's not actually that well respected in this particular world, but it's an interesting idea, I suppose. But yeah, it's challenging because we do love inanimate objects, right? Like your favorite pillow or something, or car. You know, my car died. I mean, think of these metaphors. So anyway.
That's true. People get attached to their cars.
Before we leave this, Alex, Marjorie is too embarrassed to ask this question. She asked if I would, based on your comment. What is a sex bot exactly, Alex? Yeah. Could you please describe that?
You know, and in this, I was actually going to bring you this book called Robot Ethics, which MIT was kind enough to send me. Hmm. Sex bots really exist, and fembots really exist.
What are they exactly?
Well, they're basically, they're essentially unique to Japan. Uh-huh. They're life-size, sort of audio animatronic robots that have a texture like a skin. I'm not saying they're anatomically correct yet, but there's a kind of a big expectation that they will be. And I mean, they're for hugging, and even you know, conversing with. They have nice hair or stuff like that. This is this whole kind of Japan thing.
Why, if you making a face, Mike? Why? I'm not defending this. Believe me, it's a little odd to say the least. Why is this any more preposterous? It's basically her in reality in Japan. Is it not? At least there's a physical manifestation.
What I said about the movie Her is you could see it happening. When you watch the movie, you could get why this guy falls in love with Scarlett Johansson's voice. And I suppose you could see, I mean, I suppose, you know, people have inflatable dolls.
Well, I think I got to credit this woman. I mean, whose first name I'm for some reason forgetting, but Miss Darling of MIT. Definitely made the point. I mean, in America, we
Kate Darling.
Thank you, Kate Darling. We sometimes we hide from ourselves. For instance, that what we call the internet is. I mean, you can choose your percentage, but in terms of investment, clicks, viewership, da da da, it's like what 60-65% pornography. So we sort of hide from ourselves how much money is going into pornography, and so she feels that like. For us, sort of intellectually, oh, it's over there. It's in Japan. She feels that, like, you know, money follows sex where technology is concerned. And so she and others have raised this issue of robot prostitution. They think it's
robot.
What are you talking? What? Don't you read the column?
I did read the column.
Did you hear what he said with skin and hair and willing to do things that are illegal in 59 states or 49
you know,
states or whatever?
People think it's just masterpiece theater on the internet. I got news for you. There's a lot of other stuff out there.
Okay. How well do you know it, Alex? That's what I want to know.
You've been in Japan?
Never been. I really want to go to Japan.
Apparently you do.
Yeah, naturally.
Now,
let's talk about another. Keep away from those robots, Alex. Yeah.
Let's talk about another story I assume you got from the Washington Post. This, why were you in LA? Yeah, Alex wrote a piece that's in today's paper. Serious drought? Not in LA. Why were you in LA?
I go to LA once every, for the last 10 years, I go there for a week in February because I can't stand New England. I can't afford medication.
Okay. What was your point? The reason I was interested in this column is because you referenced there's a water crisis in parts of California. Jerry Brown has proposed this, I think, $700 billion capital spending thing. He's the governor again of California. But the reason I was drawn to the piece to begin with is Chinatown, which you mentioned, one of the two or three finest movies ever made. Please. Don't say no. What, you never saw it?
I've seen it. It's so confusing. I had to read a plot summary to just describe it. So
involved. Why? Just because when he said, the thing about, you're my brother, you're my sister, you're my wife,
you're my father, you're my lover, you're my rapist.
Whatever it is.
Oh, man, it's pervy to the max.
Forget that thing. Exactly. What's the basic point of this column today, for those who haven't seen it yet?
The basic point of this column is that after writing for the Boston Globe for 27 years, I got my first photo credit.
Really? That's
Alex Bean for the Boston Globe.
Oh, my God. I didn't even notice that.
But your point is, if I may, and I read this from one of the commenters, because it's not original, is a photograph of a woman dancing in a fountain in L.A., and one of the points you make is obviously the water crisis has not struck L.A. like it has elsewhere, because look at all these fountains. But fountains just recycle water. So what does that prove?
Okay, that's the editor, to be fair, caught that before it went to print. So we actually kind of adjusted. We adjusted the wording a little bit. Because I use these fountains as these metaphors. For abundant water, and your point is exactly right. But luckily, there's a non-robot editors at the Boston Globe. Who said her first question was, "Whoa, this fountain thing doesn't really make any sense." I don't know. Like, I had that. I knew I was going to L.A. It was in fact January 26th that Brown declared the state to be in quote severe drought emergency. So I said, "Oh, I'm an op-ed columnist. Blah blah. I'll write a little piece about the drought." And I guess it's just a super simple piece. Where there just is no drought in any real seriously populated area. The Southland, when you fly over, I don't want to start lecturing here, but there's 13 million people there, and there's not a freaking drop of water. But there's no drought impact. Like, people aren't even dialing back lawn water.
Why is that? Why is there a huge problem in the agricultural part of the state and virtually no problem in the cities? Why?
Read the column.
I did read the column, but not everybody read the column. What's the explanation?
Ahead is what you said.
That is what I said. Thank you. Same.
You don't even have to be here.
But who would be savoring my own work if I weren't here?
But here's the thing. There's something a little grotesque about it in a way. Frolicking in fountains in Los Angeles while out in places like Modesto or Sonoma, wherever you mention in the piece, people are in real trouble. I mean, it's kind of weird, isn't it?
Well, a deal's a deal, basically. And agriculture gets 80% of the water that is distributed around the state. They have this incredibly complex water distribution network. And indeed, San Francisco and L.A. just managed their 20% allocation a lot better than agriculture managed its 80% allocation. And this was the Titanic, to use that metaphor again. I mean, in 30, 40 years ago, L.A. saw this coming and decided to do something about it. Mainly, curiously, they've been catching rain and storing it in aquifers. I learned something, which was interesting. I didn't know any of that. I didn't infer any of that. And it turns out that it's bizarre. The only places that where people live where there's going to be severe water shortages, at least for now, it looks like, are like Mendocino.
Mendocino, which is beautiful. It reminds you of New England. It's like
A minute. Can you pass the test? In what famous long-running television show did Mendocino, quote-unquote, cheat for a small town in Maine?
Oh.
Ooh. Cabot Cove, Maine. Can you take it?
I have no idea.
Beep. It's the opening shot to Murder, She Wrote.
Really?
Jessica lives in Cabot Cove, Maine, and that's Mendocino.
I do know this. Living out in California, as I did for a while, when I got homesick, I would go to Mendocino because it reminded me of New England.
Oh, it's gorgeous
out
there.
Yeah, it is gorgeous.
Well, don't go now because you won't be able to flush your toilet.
But here's the thing about California, though, that is very depressing, is that everything just dries up and everything turns brown. And lakes are disappear in the winter season. I mean, it is kind of really depressing.
Well, even though Alex didn't get into this, I mean, the whole water crisis thing is a huge thing in the science community. Most of us, I think it was an NPR story yesterday on our station, talking about how most people in this country treat water like they treat air, that it's an unlimited supply, that it's free, which it's not. But why are you making a face? It's a real serious problem, isn't there? Oh, is that your natural?
That's my natural face. Okay, I love you lecturing this NPR BS. Well, it's a serious problem.
It's not BS.
You just want to talk about guns or something? Jesus Christ.
We finished that. We want to move on to something else that I thought would be fun to weigh
in. How about
that
amazing fact, though?
What is it?
That the resident of Cohasset, Massachusetts uses half as much.
I know. Say it.
Now, that's bleeping interesting.
I know you can read the column and
find out. No, don't read the column. Life's too short, my friend.
The resident of Cohasset,
finish that, please.
Well, no, I had to do some quote-unquote work and research, and I'm just luxuriating in Los Angeles doing nothing.
Yeah.
So with a few clicks, I was just curious because L.A. made such a big deal. I lived there in 78, and it turns out that the per capita consumption in 1978 of a Los Angeles resident was about 180 gallons of water a day. Which is a lot.
Wow.
Do I have that right? Or is it a week?
No, it's a day. And it's now down to 123.
Now it's down to 123, which, relatively speaking, is a 50% decline. I said, I wonder how this compares. Well, it's like double, basically. It's double any place that you can name. Revere, Cohasset. The Globe did a piece in 2011.
We use less, in other words.
We use much less. And okay. I suspect it's because of, remember, the NWRA just decided to... Just charge a lot for water.
Because your lawns are all turning brown. So lots of people want to go out there and keep their lawns green. And it's not naturally green for very much of the year. Everything
you
mean
not?
Brown.
Yeah, we get rainfall. But it is kind of stunning. And I know water is a resource. And, of course, I mean, one or two readers that noticed the shout out to Cadillac Desert, this amazing book, published 30 years ago. It's long been predicted.
Marjorie, can I ask you a question before you ask Alec a question?
What?
Look at Alex for a second and close your eyes and imagine him unclothed if you can.
What?
Who does he look almost exactly like?
God.
I just realized this as I'm sitting here.
He does a little bit.
Who?
Like the sleepwalker.
You do. You really do, actually.
Really?
You do a little bit.
Yeah, which is actually kind of a compliment.
Because the artist says he's in pretty good shape.
The artist is in pretty good shape. Well, he's not six-pack abs, but he looks pretty good, if you ask me. But
he's a little slouched shoulder, isn't he?
But we wanted to ask you that because your art critic, Sebastian Smee, had a great line. I'm not going to get it exactly correct, but he talked about he thought there was a certain affected fragility by the women of Wellesley, claiming that this was an affront to their sensibilities, and that while he understood that people might initially be nervous because they might be afraid that this was a wild, crazy person out there in his underpants in the middle of the wintertime going to attack them or something, after they realize it's a bronze sculpture, they should sort of calm down. So where do you come down on the effort to get rid of the statue in the underpants on the campus of Wellesley College?
I don't think I've ever been asked a tougher question. I notice in your show when Jim always says, yes or no, yes or no. Some poor guy is squirming like a worm. And so, because yes or no, yes or no. yes. It's art. I mean, give me – this is great. I mean, it's, in a way, Sebastian said, shut up. Sebastian Smee's piece was
great. It was great. He's a beautiful writer.
None dared wish it longer, as was said in a different context. And, that's art, baby. I mean – that's great that a piece of public art, right, is exacting these responses. I mean, I don't, we can have the cheap laugh at the undergraduates of Wellesley College. I mean, but that's not necessary. It was interesting. I mean, in the piece, it's mentioned that the sculptor did a sleepwalking woman, right? I mean, so it clearly that could have been on the campus. I'm sure that would have ticked off a billion.
Yeah, but the 900 petition signers would say most sleepwalking women don't conjure up fears of predators. Is what I assume the argument would be.
What was the sleepwalking?
Dangerous to assume.
What was the sleepwalking woman wearing, please?
It's not in the piece, but let's assume she was. If a man sleeps in his boxers, perhaps this. I doubt it was. I don't know. We can't speculate what it was.
He was wearing BVDs, by the way. He was not wearing boxers.
White BVDs. I stand corrected. And Sebastian used the term Y fronts, which I think is a Britishism.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, he called them Y fronts.
Okay.
I want to talk about one other experience, if I may, before we dismiss you, Alex. When you were in LA, did you go to any fine restaurants?
Is that a trick question? I went to the hippest restaurant in Chinatown, I was told.
Okay.
And there's nobody there, but anyway.
Well, it doesn't really address my
question.
Where are
you going with this? I'm going
with this.
Can I interrupt you? You know what? 2 days ago, I bicycled on the Marvin Browdy bicycle trail.
I know. He was a big-time city councilor in Los Angeles. Unrelated.
I'm glad you caught that.
Spelled the same way.
Because, it's a lovely bicycle trail right along the
city. When I ran for city council, and I subsequently won and retired undefeated. I don't know if you're aware of that. When I ran for city council.
I thought you lost and retired 0-1.
Someone sent me a Browdy for city council bumper, a button from L.A., which is this. this other character. Oh, okay. But here's my question. In a couple of minutes, we're going to ask the listeners about how they feel when they go to a nice restaurant and the people at the next table have little tiny kids in tow who have sippy cups and are screaming and are running around the restaurant. When you go out to a decent restaurant and you're spending a decent amount of dough, and the people at the next table, I'm serious, and the people at the next table,
this is your topic?
Have little
kids. You
should
kids, keep me on for the next half hour, man.
Have little kids. Does that not drive you completely over the edge, or you're tolerant of such things? Awesome. Yes or no?
I like your style, my friend. No, it doesn't. Because 18 years ago, I was in church, and the babies were squalling, and the minister stood up there, and, you know, because everyone's looking around with those censorious glances you have for, you know, babies squalling in church. And the minister said, aren't we lucky to have these children in our church? You know what? I'll tell you, when I flew out to L.A. A week ago, I came down the aisle and I noticed I was in a seat with two mothers with tiny babies.
Oh my God.
In their laps. And being a totally negative 60-year-old horrible person, I decided I'm just going to flip the terms entirely. And I said, I must have won the lottery. I am so lucky to be sitting here. And those mothers,
wow,
it just made the next 6.5 hours of their lives, because I just wasn't this crotchety jerk. I don't really care. I like children. Let them do what they want. And I hate the kind of people who eat at those restaurants. I dare to, you know,
thank you.
I shudder to think who you're talking
about. Did the kids scream all the way to L.A. or not?
The one directly next to me did not.
Because their ears get hurt.
Yeah, the notion that Alex was okay with that is such a preposterous, unbelievable, and it's not even worth discussing. By the way, the sleepwalking, our colleagues have just told us, sleepwalking woman statue was wearing underpants and nothing else, nothing on top. I was not aware of that. Did you
well,
know?
I don't know if that would go over well with the women of Wellesley either, do you think?
No, probably not. But to return to the original trite point, I mean, it's great. No, it's just great that people are talking about public art, and some, you know,
that's
we've
a
all
good
sat,
point actually.
Yeah, and indeed, my heavens, the Globe has published, you know, many dozens of articles about how bad public art is in Boston, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, the guy is unbelievably talented. I mean, it's so real looking.
Yeah.
People are reaching up, as Jared Bowen said yesterday, went out to Wellesley College to look at it in person. The arts editor here, to try to touch the underpants because they look like they're really cloth, and of course they're not. And many people did think it was a real person. So the guy is unbelievably talented. Which is really great. I can't believe he's down with people sitting next to him at some snazzy restaurant either.
No. Alex, you're talking about. No, obviously, it's untrue.
Although, you know, people that go to different countries say that if you go like to France or Spain or Italy, they're much more cordial toward children out at meals than we are in the United States.
Yeah, I'm just not buying into the foodie hatred, man.
Hey, Alex,
yeah,
what are you writing next? You never give us a preview. Do you know what you're doing next, or you just don't tell us?
Thank you for asking, as I say in Newton.
What are you doing?
You know what I'm going to do? Because I'm under a little deadline pressure for reasons I won't explain.
Sure.
I'm going to do a love note to Dave Epstein, who has ruled my world.
The weather guy on Boston.com?
His Twitter feed has just ruled my world for the last 2.5 months. Like, I was overseas, like, trying to figure out if Logan was open or not. And whenever he ships in the European weather data, I'm going to do a whole thing about weather nerdery. And even though if Dave Epstein is listening, which I suspect he's not, I'm not going to actually interview Dave Epstein, but I've already interviewed some weather nerds from the Weather Underground, and I'm looking for a couple of other weather nerds.
Really?
Because this has been the winter of weather nerdism.
Absolutely.
I mean, polar vortex, you know, this and that. I think we've really deepened our ability to misunderstand weather trends.
Alex's explanation of his next column is longer than his next column. But Alex, it's great to
and
see
a lot
you.
Less coherent.
There's a Japanese robot maker in the hall waiting to talk to you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Alex sayonara.
Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe and author of numerous secret books that shall continue to remain.
The readers just haven't heard
unnamed.
Of.
Alex, great to see you.
Good to
as
see
always.
You, Alex. You guys.
Up next, we're going to talk about what we just talked about with Alex. Kids eating next to you at some snazzy restaurant or wine bar. Should there be parameters when it comes to towing the kids along for a night out on the town? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.